Okay, so today we're talking about mediated communication. And so you remember, we just mentioned it, the three circles in the Venn diagram. So one of them is communication. People, when they collaborate, oftentimes they need to be able to talk to each other, speak, and see each other. And so how do you communicate these days? Well, we communicate face-to-face. Still. And then we use tools like physical mail. When is the last time you wrote the letter? Yes?
But the postcard thing.
Postcard, yes. Then there's electronic means of communication, telephone, email, instant messaging, texting. I don't know why I put two items here. Video conferencing. So any other tools you use for communicating with others?
Post-its.
Hmm?
Post-its.
Post-its. Okay. it is a support to communication, yes. Okay, so I've covered it all here. I don't know. Well, we'll see. So it's always interesting to look at the history of communication tools because people have often made big mistakes in understanding people's needs for communication. So for example, the telephone. So the idea of communicating sound over electric lines is pretty old. But originally, it was not designed as a person-to-person communication system. In fact, it was seen as a way to give people access to information. So it's more like you would pick up the phone to talk to a service that would give you the weather or the time or things like this. It was also seen as a way to broadcast information. So for example, an early use of the telephone was to have in the large department stores where you have a manager who's managing a floor of the big store with a bunch of salesperson on the ground. The idea is that when the manager had to give orders to them, he would pick up his phone. All the phones would ring, everybody would pick up, and they would pass orders. So it was seen as a one-to-many communication device. And it took times for it to become a person-to-person communication device, to be installed in people's homes, and to develop into what we know today. Interestingly, similar things happened with other telecommunication systems much later. For example, in France, the Minitel system was, who knows what the Minitel is? Yeah, the French people have heard it from their parents. And the others don't even know what I'm talking about. So in the 70s, the French telecom organization decided to create a terminal and an information network. So to get rid of the white pages and the yellow pages, that was costing them a lot of money to print these big books every year and distribute them to millions of people. And so to put this the phone book online and give people the terminal to access the phone book. But they didn't stop there, and they decided to also support services. And not only services that they would implement and run, but also services, also services that other people, companies or individuals could develop. And they came up with a very interesting funding or business model, I should say, where if you were running an information service, I don't know, you want to run a service to, or the university wants to run a service to show what we would call today a website, they would have to put in the infrastructure of the servers where people would connect to get the information. But the billing of the cost of accessing the service would be billed to your telephone bill. So the telephone company would, you know, have the burden of billing everyone, but that's what they're very good at, right? As later history showed. So, but that means that for someone, the cost of access to becoming a service provider was very low, because you didn't have to care about billing, you didn't have to care about advertising, because there was a funding model where people were ready to pay to get information. Now, the interesting part of this is, again, it was a system designed for accessing information. Like, I used it a lot to know, you know, the time the flight was going to land, if I had to go to the airport, so I wouldn't have to wait for hours at the airport. I mean, I know all of this today is like, what? Of course. But at the time, you know, there was no way to know when a flight was landing. You could call the number, and it would never answer, and that was it. So it was a very clever system. It was government sponsored. You would get the terminal for free if you agreed to not get the phone book anymore, and then you had access to all these services. Now, some people, you know, like with the early days of cell phones and texting, got very high bills and realized that, you know, it could be very expensive, but the costs were, in fact, fairly low when you knew what to do. The interesting thing is that in 77, before they deployed the system, they ran an experiment in this city very nearby called Venise, with, I think, 700 households. And they installed the system in those households, and they tested it for several months to see how people were using it, if people were using it, and to do adjustment to the system. And one of the features they put in the system was that the engineers from the telecom organization could, in fact, see what the user was seeing at a particular time on their display. The display was very crude. It was 25 by 80 characters. It's funky semi-graphics. Black and white in the beginning. And in order to make the best out of the trial, they built into the system they deployed a little messaging capability so that they could type a message by hand that would display on the bottom line of the user's terminal. And they would do that when they could see what the user was doing and that the user was struggling and couldn't, you know, do what they wanted to do. And so from the user perspective, you had this magic message that appears saying, oh, what if you did this? So it's kind of a Wizard of Oz technique in a sense. And I think that, you know, it's a very clever way to make the best out of a trial so you don't have people stuck and you know, put the terminal in the closet and forget about it. Now, what they didn't anticipate is that some people who were smarter than the others or more geek discovered this messaging system and discovered a way to use it for themselves so they could send messages on each other's screen. And of course, the telecom engineers discovered that and they were very unhappy about it. But in fact, it completely changed the fate of the Minitel, because the Minitel, very quickly, what made it a success was not the information services, like the schedule of the planes or the phone book or whatever. It was messaging applications, chat applications. Now, a lot of these chat applications were called Messagerie Rose, pink chat, which was, you know, sex chat. So you had ads everywhere. It was 3615, hula. And for those of you who don't know, I don't know if any of you are subscribers to Free, internet provider, Free. So Mr. Xavier Niel made his fortune in selling those services. In fact, it gets worse than that because he was also prosecuted for things in connection with that. But so that was a big success, and nobody had imagined that people would want to use this kind of technology to have chat system, and not just the pink type, because there were regular ones that were heavily used as well, instead of just using it for accessing information. And in fact, if you move another 20 years, the same mistake was done by the telcos with texting. When they created SMS, short message service, they thought it was a gimmick, nobody would use it. And they were completely overwhelmed by the fact that instantly millions and billions of text messages were exchanged. And so it's interesting to me that there is this sort of history repeating itself of people not understanding our need to communicate. But there are also mistakes about understanding how people communicate and what they want. So in the 50s, the American, in particular, telecom companies and AT&T, decided that, talking to someone was nice, but having a picture would be much better. And so they developed the picture phone, which is this device here. I think this is a picture from an earlier version. So, have you seen the movie 2001? Yes? So, there is a little clip there. How is this going to work? To go here. It's going to do weird things. No, this one I have in the browser, sorry. Okay, so this is the segment. Do I have sound? About the picture.
Oh, wait. I'll make a couple of phone calls. You go on ahead, the restaurant will meet you there.
Right.
Sorry, it's not very loud. So it goes into this booth. It has still the Bell logo. But it means everybody recognized that this was a phone booth. It's using a card. I don't think they had Spanish cards when the movie was made. Good morning, Sam.
Hello.
And he's calling his daughter. Now you remember he's
smart?
On some planet, right?
What are you doing?
So tell me if you see anything weird with that.
Where's Mommy?
Shopping.
Well, who's taking care of you?
Rachel.
May I speak to Rachel, please?
Go to the bathroom. Are you coming to my party tomorrow?
I'm sorry, sweetheart, but I can't.
Why not?
So it's her birthday, so
you know,
she's asking.
Daddy's traveling. Very sorry about it, but I just can't.
I am.
I'm going to send you a very nice present, though.
What?
Anything special that you want?
Yes.
What?
Telephone.
We got lots of telephones already. Can't you think of anything else you want for your birthday? Something very special?
Yes.
What?
A bush baby.
A bush baby? Well, we'll have to see about that. Listen, sweetheart, I want you to tell Mommy something for me. Will you remember?
Yeah.
Tell Mommy that I telephoned, okay?
Yeah.
So then I'll try to telephone again tomorrow. And will you tell her that?
Yeah.
Okay, sweetheart. Have a nice birthday tomorrow.
Bye.
Have a nice birthday party tomorrow, too, huh?
Bye.
Okay, now take care and be a good girl, won't you?
Bye.
Bye-bye. Happy birthday.
Okay, and it costs $1.70. Okay, anything weird you see in there? I don't think you're allowed to answer first.
Well, the camera is tracking the door.
Yes.
So maybe it's a little bit different.
So they have tracking technology.
Yeah.
Yes?
She's also looking directly into the camera instead of at the display.
Yes. So we see her looking at us, which means she's looking into the camera. But we see him looking at the screen. But we never see what she sees. Because, and I'm sure if they had shown the other side, which, I don't know, from a cinematography perspective, it's interesting that it's only one-sided. But if they had shown the other side, I'm sure they would have shown him looking right in the camera, which is not the reality. And, I mean, now you all use Skype and these things, and you know that even though the camera is right above the screen, there is this effect that if you want to look the other in the eyes, you have to look into the camera, and therefore you cannot look at their eyes. So the thing is that the picture phone was a disaster, a commercial disaster. People didn't want it. Now, there's a quote here from the 1964 World's Fair. Survey results indicated that most people did not like picture phone. The equipment was too bulky, the controls were awkward, and the picture was small. Now, it is also another thing that the picture size in video communication systems is very important, because we are used to life size. People, you know, looking a certain size or not at a certain distance. And so when you play with that, weird things happen. But in fact, there was other reasons why it didn't take on. And again, in France, but that was later than that, they did a test in Biarritz in the southwest of France, where they put fiber optics at a time where it was not really commonplace to have fiber optics. Networks in the city and connected a number of households together with a better version of the picture phone to talk to each other. And they realized people didn't like it. Because speaking on the phone is one thing, but seeing the other person when you are, you know, getting up in the morning or you're busy doing other things, etc., is very intrusive. The image is very intrusive. And so people have gotten used to using the phone with this version of plausible deniability that I talked about the other day, where, you know, you pretend you're having their full attention, but in fact you're fiddling with something else or you're getting dressed or something like this. And so one of the reasons why the picture phone didn't work is there was a button to say, you know, do I send the video, yes or no? But if you don't show the video, it looks like you are being rude or you're hiding something. And if you show the video, then it puts a lot more constraints on the way you handle the communication. So the picture phone still doesn't exist. Interestingly, it's been taken over by Skype, but that's on computers. It's a different thing. Really. So then what happened is, since the need for audiovisual communication was not obvious in the home, people turned to work. And from early on, systems were deployed to support meeting rooms, where one side of the room was in the room and the other side was somewhere else, connected through audio-video communication channels. So we have an example here, another one there from Polycom. Now, these were systems that were designed to support high-level meetings. First of all, they're expensive. Typically, still today, if you want a room like this, you have to pay between $500,000 and $1 million. But they do a very nice job. The seats are very good. Leather is excellent. They paint the room. They put lighting so that you don't look like someone getting out of jail. They have high quality cameras. They have microphone arrays, so the sound can be spatialized and all that. So it's really systems that are designed for CEO to CEO talk, you know, serious business talk. And in fact, when you go to these rooms, what's really interesting is that in this kind of setting, if you're in the middle, things work pretty well, I would say. For example, here the cameras are in between here at eye height. So the effect we're talking about is much less visible. But so this is a small room, the bigger ones, or they just sound like this with several levels. But the further away you're from the center, the more weird it is and unnatural. So it's really designed, concentrates that is for the important person in the middle to have the best experience. So the other thing is that these things are expensive, so you need to book the room in advance. And then there's always some problem, and so you need an engineer that knows how to fix things. And unless you pay a lot of money, the problem of sound and eye contact are really, really bad. So I mean, many companies use this very often these days. It costs them a lot of money, and it's still very far from the face-to-face meeting. And it's interesting because it's actually pretty close to face-to-face. But the thing they miss completely is that when you have a face-to-face meeting, it's not just the two groups enter two different doors, sit in front of each other for 2 hours, and then they go off and disappear. There's the before the meeting where people greet each other, they have coffee or something. There's the after the meeting. There are side talks. In the real meeting, people may get up and on the side and things like this. And so this assumes a model of communication that is very strict. And in real life, it's not. And so I think one of the reasons for the failure of these systems is that, again, they don't take into account the way people really communicate in the real world. So one of the problems we have with video is this issue of eye contact. Humans are extremely good at detecting eye contact. And not only that, I can say when I look at you, you look at me, this is eye contact. But I can also look at someone looking elsewhere and knowing where this person is looking very precisely. Right? So this is called eye gaze awareness, being aware of where the other person is looking. And we are, our brain is wired to recognize gaze. So we are very sensitive to this thing. So the problem of eye contact, of not being able to have the camera in the eyes of the person whose image is on the screen, is really a big issue. So there are solutions to this. One of them is the video tunnel, where you put a half-silvered mirror. So this is a scene from the side. You put a half-silvered mirror here. The virtual person is like behind the screen here, and you're looking from here. And so through the half-silvered mirror, the image of your face, and therefore your eye, is reflected here, and into another mirror and another camera. The camera can be vertical. But through the half-silver mirror, you also see the image of the other person, which is captured in the same way. And so you have true eye contact with a relatively cheap technology. There's nothing really difficult with that. The only problem with the half-silver mirror is that it's less bright. You lose half the brightness. And it's been installed in some media spaces in the 90s. And it worked very well. Now, the thing is, if you really want to have eye contact, you should not only support this, but also the notion that I can change my point of view on the remote space. So not only the system should replicate the idea that I have cameras in my eyes, but also the fact that my eyes can move with my head and the rest of my body. Because in real life, we constantly move, which is actually one of the major cues to understand distance. So in 1995, Bill Gaber the same Gaver I've talked about before, about affordances of sound, has created a video window. So what it did is, now, you all know pan, zoom, tilt, or pan, tilt, zoom cameras, PTZ cameras. It's a camera, usually it's a surveillance camera, which is mounted on a motor support, so it can pan left and right, tilt, up and down, and zoom. Now the thing is, this is not what our eyes are doing. Well, first, I don't have zooming in my eyes, personally. To zoom, I need to go close, right? And the optics of it are different than zooming. And then I can turn my head, but I also move. And in fact, it's a combination of turning and moving that gives me different perspectives. So if I'm behind a window and I can see the license plate of this car, I'm going to move my head and turn it so I can see a part that was hidden. If I just do pan and tilt, it doesn't change what I see. Right? So pan, tilt, zoom cameras are just dumb. So what Bill Gaver did is he created a frame, and I wish I had a picture here, but he took a frame and he mounted the camera so that it was a small, what's called a thumb camera, so the size of a thumb. So he mounted the camera so that it could be, the two ends of the mount were controlled. So it could move it like this, but it could also translate it and combine the two. So it could be set, so I specify a point in the scene, and the camera is going to move, always pointing to that direction. So instead of having a pan, tilt, zoom, I have something that's conceptually, you know, would be able to move everywhere to and in any direction. And what he did is that he coupled that with very simple head motion detection, so that when you were in front of the device and you could see in the middle of the screen of what was captured by the remote camera, if I moved my head, the camera at the other end would move like this, move like that. And so it would exactly replicate what I was doing here when I was sort of going like this. And it's a funny thing because when you experience that, it completely changes your perception of the remote world. You really feel like you are there, which you don't with a regular camera or even if you have control with a pan zoom tilt. Now, this is a complicated setup. The noise of the system was kind of annoying, I must say, because you had these these four motors moving the camera around. So, you know, technology could certainly be improved, but it gives a very nice experience of being in the remote space. Now, another cheap approach is to say, well, you know, I don't want to have a moving camera. I don't want this house of a mirror. And the house of a mirror, anyway, is not going to work when we have more than two people in the communication, because it can do eye contact with one person, but everybody is going to think I'm looking them in the eye. So when you have multi-party communication, what do you do? Well, one easy solution is to duplicate the cameras, monitors, and this is what Abby Selin did with the Hydras here. And I think I have a video of this. What did I do? Did I quit? Ah. Sorry. No, I don't want.
Let's see.
Okay, I think I'm going to save. except I don't want to save here. I told you I was tired.